What was this? Weird sounds all around me. What could it be? My curiosity compelled me to start.
HPPodcraft.com.
The next night I did not sleep well. Probably my health was a little disordered. I was oppressed with perplexity and doubt. Once or twice, I had a feeling of intense fear for which I could perceive no definite reason. I remember creeping noiselessly into the great hall where the little people were sleeping in the moonlight. That night, Weena was among them, and feeling reassured by their presence. It occurred to me, even then, that in the course of a few days, the moon must pass through its last quarter and the nights grow dark, when the appearances of these unpleasant creatures from below, these whitened lemurs, this new vermin that had replaced the old, might be more abundant. And on both these days, I had the restless feeling of one who shirks an inevitable duty. I felt assured that the time machine was only to be recovered by boldly penetrating these underground mysteries, yet I could not face the mystery. If only I had had a companion, it would have been different. But I was so horribly alone, and even to clamber down into the darkness of the well appalled me. I don't know if you will understand my feeling, but I never felt quite safe at my back.
It seems our time traveler is feeling a little out of his element, as the threat of Morlocks all up in your business can make a fella feel downright bummed.
Well, he just wishes he had a companion. What our hero didn't realize is that while there are a lot of complex systems involved in time travel, none is more important than the buddy system.
Too true.
That's why we don't do this podcast alone.
No?
It's a dangerous world out there. You got Morlocks up in your business, a bunch of Cthulhus running around. We need a team to confront them.
That's right.
I'm proud to be a part of that team, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am also proud to be part of that team as Chris Lackey. And teaming up with us once again is Greg Johnson.
Greg Johnson is the star of YouTube. He is the star of YouTube. I didn't know if you know that.
Yes, I knew that.
Yes. And he's also an internet radio sensation as part of quietandbold.com.
Quietandbold.com.
He wanted to let listeners know that he's also branching out into live appearances. I don't know if you knew this.
Oh, I didn't know.
But Greg is now available for birthday parties. Not kids parties. Oh, grown-up okay. Parties.
Oh.
He's available, though. He doesn't really do an act. No payment is necessary. But if you just contact him, he'll come to your party. So... Like, the truth is just Greg's lonely. That's all I'm saying. So, invite him to your party. I wanted to tell you, since you recommended it to me, I rented The Time Machine, motion picture from 1960.
Yeah.
As with most of these filmed motion pictures, I don't really get around to watching them until it's late at night, and I often fall asleep 10 minutes in or so.
Sure.
That was the case last night. But I gleaned some important things from the film. First of all, our old friend Reber Clark, he said, pay attention to the Russell Garcia score when I watch it. And he was right. It's good. It's an excellent score. I really like it. In fact, after the main titles, the first track on that score is called London 1900 Philby's Theme. And so, okay, this is why I'm a little angry with the film.
Yeah.
Philby's in there right away. We see Philby before we even see the time traveler. They're having that dinner scene with the other bozos where they're waiting around for the time traveler to show up. And Philby's there. He's got red hair, but he is the most agreeable person you could ever meet.
What?
Yes. Everybody else is angry that the time traveler hasn't shown up yet for dinner. They're arguing, but not Philby. He's relaxed. He's like, chill out, everybody. Everything's going to be cool. Everybody else is argumentative except Philby. And in fact, the time traveler, it's the actor Rod Taylor. They have a couple scenes that aren't in the book. He jumps forward to 1917, and he meets Philby's son, also has red hair, but also one of the nicest people you've ever met.
He
genuinely wants to help Rod Taylor out. So I feel like there's some Philby denial going on in that film.
Wow.
Like, they want us to forget just how bad it was in the book when Philby was disagreeing with everybody and ruining everything. I'm down with it when filmmakers need to change stuff.
Sure.
You know, when they do an adaptation or they try to make an old character fresh. Female Ghostbusters, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, sure.
Black James Bond, no problem. I'm on board. But agreeable Philby?
Yeah.
It's a bridge too far.
Oh, what a ripoff. I seem to remember that movie being pretty faithful adaptation of the book.
So far, it is, except for Philby.
Wow.
For some people, they probably don't even perceive it. But us folks who are book readers, we know. Anyway, I'll get back to you when I finish watching the movie. The machine itself is awesome in it.
Yeah.
But we are all about the literature here, and we're halfway through this book, into the third quarter of The Time Machine. And this is where most stories generally get scary and desperate for the hero, in this third quarter.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen here. So what's happened so far?
Our time traveler, who we affectionately call Herb, has thrown himself 800,000 years into the future, give or take a few decades, and he has found that humanity has splintered into two groups, the feeble Eloi on the surface and the capable yet creepy Morlocks who live underground. Herb's time machine is missing, and he's trying to find out what happened to it and what kind of relationship the creatures of Earth have with each other.
He's pretty sure that the Morlocks are the ones that stole his time machine, though why he doesn't know. By the way, Wells, when he was calling these devolved people Morlocks, he could have been inspired by the Morlacks, M-O-R-L-A-C-H-S, an ethnic group in the Balkans, which attracted the attention of West and Central European travelers and writers who were described and depicted in various writings as an archetype of primitive people, backwardness, barbarism, etc. The Morlocks. There's a connection here with the Morlocks and a lot of the supernatural horror and literature authors as well that we should mention. I mean, this fixation on little people living in the earth.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Arthur Macken is writing all these little people stories right around the same time as this, the evil,
right.
The evil little people.
And Worms of the Earth with Robert D. Howard.
Yes, they're this, of course, influenced Lovecraft. And right, Tolkien was a big fan of the time machine, referenced it many times. Of course, his treatment of little people in the earth is the only benign one, because he's got the hobbits.
Right.
But everybody else has them terrorizing folks. I think they're the kind of prototype for the cannibalistic humanoid underground dweller.
Chud!
Of Chud. That's right. Well, Herb has already seen the Morlocks, and he knows that they enter and exit the surface world via these wells that are scattered around. And there's this giant green palace-type structure off in the distance that he wants to go explore, but he knows that going to explore that would just be a distraction. He's got to embrace his fear, go underground now before it gets too late, and try and find his time machine.
He goes into one of the wells, and there are these footholds, kind of bars, rungs to almost like ladders, but they're not, they're just kind of all over the place inside the well.
Yeah.
And he decides that he's going to go down there and just see what's what. Weena, his Eloi girlfriend, follows him to this well, but she's really freaked out that he's going down there. He kisses her, says goodbye. She watches him go down in total shock, and then she starts screaming, and he goes like, no, calm down, it's okay, I'm fine. He's smiling at her the whole time, and it's a long climb down, and at about 200 feet, one of the bar handhold thingies bends, and he almost falls. He catches himself, but he's so tired of making this climb down that he has to, like, take a rest, and when he's at that point, he looks up and all he can see is this blue disc, which is, you know, the top of the well and the outline of Weena looking down the well at him. But it's completely black down there.
It's like the ring. He's seeing the ring.
He is. Herb finds this little spot to rest. The machine sounds that are kind of the thudding machinery that is part of this place is very loud down here. As he's resting, he feels something touch him, and he quickly lights a match, and then he sees these things. Their eyes were abnormally large and sensitive, just as are the pupils of the abysmal fishes, and they reflected the light in the same way. I have no doubt they could see me in that rayless obscurity, and they did not seem to have any fear of me apart from the light. So the match that he lit freaks them out and they run off. And he uses the wall to kind of feel his way around as he's going because, you know, one match doesn't really light anything.
No.
But he gets closer and deeper to these machine sounds. They're getting loud and loud. And he's totally blind down there. Like, he can't see anything, but he's pretty sure that they can see in the dark. And he says to himself, "You're in for it now." I'm not sure if he means, like, they're in for it, like he's going to go in there and kick their ass in the dark with his little matches?
No, I think he means himself, like...
Okay, great.
They're just sensitive to the light, but otherwise, as you said, they're not afraid of him. Yeah, he's getting into deeper and deeper trouble right now.
You would turn around probably at this point and go, you know, I'm a little out of my depth here, literally. I need to go back and formulate a better plan than just going down...
I mean, I guess, sure, it's just sort of an exploratory, but yeah, once I got down there and saw that, I'd be right back up those.
They flipping touched him, man.
Yeah.
That's too close.
He lights another match, and he steps into this vast cavern.
Yeah, Herb smells blood and finds this table with meat laid out on it, and he wonders what animal all this meat is coming from, because, you know, remember, there's no cows or pigs, so what is it? I know what it is.
Then his match goes out, just as he's seen this slaughter table. As matches always find the creepiest time to go out.
They sure do. And he says he wishes he brought a Kodak, a camera, I assume, because the camera, he could take a picture with the flash of it, and then later on he could see what was actually down there at his leisure.
Yeah.
He's ready to fight. You know, if he's got to fight, he's going to fight. He says, "I stood there with only the weapons and the power that nature endowed me with, hands, feet, and teeth."
Yeah.
"These and four safety matches that still remain to me." But teeth, man, he's no rules. And he's making himself out to be pretty badass.
Well, yeah, he says, I would say hands and teeth, but he threw feet in there. So that means he's got some roundhouse kicks he's going to deliver on these Morlocks. He's been practicing kicking as high as his head back home. Now he's going to find out.
He sure is. But, you know, he really has got himself in a real pickle.
While I stood in the dark, a hand touched mine. Lank fingers came feeling over my face, and I was sensible of a peculiar, unpleasant odor. I fancied I heard the breathing of a crowd of those dreadful little beings about me. I felt the box of matches in my hand being gently disengaged, and other hands behind me plucking at my clothing. The sense of these unseen creatures examining me was indescribably unpleasant. The sudden realization of my ignorance of their ways of thinking and doing came home to me very vividly in the darkness. I shouted at them as loudly as I could. They started away, and then I could feel them approaching me again. They clutched at me more boldly, whispering odd sounds to each other. I shivered violently and shouted again, rather discordantly. This time, they were not so seriously alarmed, and they made a queer laughing noise as they came back at me. I will confess I was horribly frightened.
He lights one of his last matches, then lights a piece of paper that he had in his pocket, and that scares him off pretty good because it's a pretty huge flame compared to just these little matches. He rushes back the way he came in.
You can scarce imagine how nauseatingly inhuman they looked, the Morlocks. Those pale, chinless faces and great, lidless, pinkish gray eyes. Lidless, oh man.
Well, yeah, I guess they wouldn't really need to close their eyes to keep light out.
The caves naturally secrete Visine.
They manage to grab him again, so he lights another match. They run off, then he gets a bit further, then he lights another match. He climbs up the bars, and as he's climbing up, they're right on him, so he's kicking at them as they're climbing up after him. And he felt sick with exhaustion as he reached the top, and he flopped down on the ground outside of the well into the bright sunlight.
Into chapter 7.
He's got an enemy now, and he knows when night comes, those Morlocks are going to be on him like mold on a... Morlock? I don't know. I don't know what I was going to say.
I don't know if they were described as moldy, but I'm sure they are.
Sure, why not?
Well, he knows that he's got the Morlocks to take on, but what he doesn't know is that there was an episode of Challenge of the Super Friends.
Oh, no.
In 1978, in which the Legion of Doom travels to the future and teams up with the Morlocks.
What?
To try and conquer the world. That's right.
How did that work out for them?
I don't think it worked out well, but at this point, he might have to tangle with Lex Luthor.
Oh, geez, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, Cheetah, that woman that wore a cat suit. I don't know what her powers were other than that. Black Manta, Captain Cold.
Solomon Grundy.
These are guys you wouldn't want to run into in a dark alley, and he may run into him.
With just some matches. The new moon is coming, and the Morlocks are too. Herb is rejigging his hypothesis about them. Maybe a long time ago, the Eloi were aristocracy and the Morlocks their servants, but since time has passed, the power kind of shifted. The Eloi are no longer in control.
Yeah, they still possess the Earth, but that's merely because the Morlocks over time evolved to find the daylit surface intolerable.
Right.
It's just something to keep them occupied.
Yeah.
The Morlocks make their garments, they maintain them in their habitual needs, but this is just something they do out of tradition. It says as a man enjoys killing animals in sport, because ancient and departed necessities had impressed it on the organism. So they do it as a means of habit, but really they're the dominant force.
And it could be too that the Morlocks are maintaining it for a reason as well, which hasn't quite dawned on him yet. Well, Herb starts thinking about this a little bit and ponders that meat that he saw down there. Mm. And he's going, wait, how big was that meat exactly? And what part of the beast was it from? Oh, well, I'm not going to think about that anymore.
Right.
That afternoon, he goes with Weena away from where they've been, about 16 miles, and he thinks.
He's looking up at that palace of green porcelain that he'd seen earlier. He's starting to think, I got to put together some kind of defense plan against these Morlocks. Maybe there will be something there to help, because this is the only structure he's seen that's different from those big sleeping palaces they have.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to head there. And in the evening, there was this little line that said, in the evening, taking Weena like a child upon my shoulder, I went up the hills toward the southwest. On his shoulder? How small is she?
When I was reading this, it got even more creepy to me. I thought she was just kind of petite, you know, like maybe 5'1 or something like that. But man, maybe she's like 4 foot or something.
I don't know.
It's really creeping me out. Maybe he just means like she's riding on his shoulders, like chicken fighting, kind
right.
of riding on
maybe
his shoulders.
That, maybe
I don't
that's
know. But again, that's weird, too.
It's
who does that?
The smaller she gets, the stranger their relationship is.
It really makes me uncomfortable. But as they're running around, his shoes are falling apart.
Yeah.
He was wearing his indoor shoes when he decided to time travel, so ill-prepared.
Well, yeah, a nail is working its way up through the sole. It kind of gives this whole thing a diehard feeling.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay, so he's wearing the wrong thing, but what do you think would be the best gear for time travel? If you were going into the future, how should you be dressed?
Some sensible shoes, for crying out loud.
Sensible
shoes.
Some
nice hiking boots, yeah, sure.
Anything you wear is going to look weird in the future, possibly, right?
Who knows what the future is going to be like. If current trends keep going the way they are, you can get away with wearing old-style things. You know, people wear old-fashioned clothes all the time. You know, old is new, and I think that that's going to be... You know, like, I mean, look, in the 1980s, like, it was cool to dress like you were in the 1950s. And now it's, like, cool to dress like you're in the 1890s.
Right. So you're saying that if I just wear the t-shirt and jeans I have on now, in the future, they might be like, oh, look at that hipster.
Probably.
That's a crappy way to enter the future. You know what I would dress like? I would dress like a clown. Because if you think about it, clown costumes have not really changed. Over time, very much.
That's true.
In a rare once in a while, I will see a clown driving or on. I was on the subway not that long ago, and there was a clown on there. Other than taking the opportunity to make the lame joke, you know, to Heather, can you believe the clowns they're letting on this subway now? But I always assume, oh, that person is either going to a children's party.
Sure.
Or coming from one.
Yeah.
Unlike Greg Johnson. But so, you know, I just assume that would be the best thing to wear.
Yeah, well, I hate to poke holes in your theory, but, you know, a lot of people are scared of clowns and don't feel really comfortable with them around. And maybe clowns might not be around in the future. And then that you would really be freaking people out.
Well, thanks, Chris. I guess I'll go as a sad clown then. Since you're going to rain on my parade, I'm going to put up my little umbrella and be sad.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. So Weena always liked putting flowers in Herb's pockets.
Right. She doesn't understand the pockets. Why would you need these?
Yeah.
But then eventually she figured out, oh, those are for flowers.
And this reminds Herb. He goes, oh, hey, Victorian dudes who I'm telling the story to, grab my coat that I had on before. And one of the guys brings his coat over and he pulls out from the pockets two withered white flowers. They're like, yeah, big deal. That doesn't prove anything.
They're like, wow, future flowers. This is amazing.
Suitably unimpressed, he continues on with the story. Weena and Herb start to bed down for the night. Weena wants to go back to the place where they've been sleeping and communicates this to him. But he says, it's not going to be safe because the Morlocks are going to be coming for me and probably anybody else they can get hold of. He decides to wait it out on an open hill, I guess, to see them coming if they do show up. But Weena falls asleep pretty quickly, and he just looks up at the stars and starts noticing that they're different. And he gets really existential and thinks about his and humanity's smallness in the grand scale of the universe. And he thinks about the species that split into two, the fear that the Eloi have of them, and then it crosses his mind, the meat. He's like, I do know where that meat came from. It's the Eloi.
Yeah.
They're eating the Eloi.
It's like he always knew it, but he's just admitted it to himself.
Yeah. Herb stays up all night and there's no attack. And the sun starts coming up and he's like, yes, I did it. I'm awesome.
When he's pondering how mankind's diet may have changed over time, too,
mm-hmm.
he says, even now, man is far less discriminating and exclusive in his food than he was, far less than any monkey. So that was interesting. Thinks that humans are getting more omnivorous with evolution. They're eating more and more things, you know, because it says possibly the Morlocks were living on rats and vermin for a while. The prejudice against human flesh is no deep-seated instinct. He thinks that cannibalism is not abhorrent to us from instinct. It's just because we have other types of food that keep us from doing it. But once those food sources run out, probably wouldn't be that big of a deal for us to start eating other folks if we could make the right mental adjustment.
Sure. Well, chimpanzees eat other chimpanzees. That's well documented. So
that happens, right? So when he said far less than any monkey, I was like, hey, wait a minute. And then I went, oh, no, chimpanzees are apes. They're closer.
They're apes.
Monkeys, I think, mostly it's, you know, fruits and bark and stuff like that.
And Hot Pockets, too.
They do like Hot Pockets and Lunchables. Yeah.
They go back to the Eloi, and Weena and the other Eloi start dancing. And Herb can't stop thinking about them being used as cattle.
The woods that they're bunked in, they were so scary at night. But once the sun is up, the Eloi come in and just start getting down, obliviously.
It's like American Bandstand. Now, for Herb... It's A-team time. He's going to find some metal to make some weapons and armor. He's going to make some torches to blind and burn the Morlocks. And he also wants to design some kind of battering ram to get those doors open.
Yeah, he needs to knock down the doors underneath that Sphinx statue. That seems like the main entrance to the Morlock village down there.
He goes to this place, the Palace of Green Porcelain, where he thinks that he's going to find the things that he needs to kick some ass.
And he sees along the palace there's an inscription in some unknown character. He asks Weena, what do you think this is? And she's like, doo-dee-doo-boo-boo-doo-boo. She doesn't know how to read or write. She's just a fool. No idea.
Turns out it's some kind of museum.
Yes.
It's got old skeletons of giant sloths and a brontosaurus. Some of the exhibits are preserved while others are just piles of dust. And he finds some machine parts that he thinks he could use maybe to fight some Morlocks. As he's deep in thought about the machine, Weena comes up to him and startles him. And then he realizes that the sun's kind of getting lower in the sky. It's getting dark inside of the place. And he notices footprints and he hears sounds. And the Morlocks are about. They're up in that place, lurking around. And while he was wasting time being all brainy, the Morlocks are getting their pounce on. And he doesn't have weapons, fire, or armor. None of the things on his list were completed. But Herb sees this handle on a machine. He jumps on top of the machine and he rips it off. And now he's got this really solid club. And he decides that he really wants to get his murder on, which I thought was kind of strange. He says, I rejoined her with a mace in hand, more than sufficient, I judged, for any Morlock skull I might encounter. I have longed very much to kill a Morlock or so. Very inhuman, you may think, to want to go killing one's descendants, but it was impossible somehow to feel any humanity in these things. Only my disinclination to leave Weena, and a persuasion that if I began to slake my thirst for murder, my time machine might suffer, restrained me from going straight down the galley and killing the brutes I heard. I kind of felt this myself. Like, I really wanted to see some Morlocks get hurt.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure why. I mean, they took the time machine, and they have allegedly eaten Eloi. He hasn't seen them attack anybody.
You're like a lawyer for the Morlocks. Allegedly ate Eloi. Allegedly.
Well, was it because they laughed at him? Remember, because he was at the door and he's trying to open it and he heard some snickering going on in the door? Is that what did it?
Why he wants to murder a Morlock or so?
Yeah.
I love that expression, too. Yeah, I'll probably go down to the pub, kill a Morlock or so.
At the pub?
Yeah. That might be, yeah, because they laughed at him and made him feel small. No, I just think it's because they're devolved and there's some kind of revulsion that he's feeling
right deep
down that is inspiring this violence. You know he'd be rocking these Morlocks too. I think that might be part of it, just the competence. Because as creepy as they are, they haven't had much to fight over.
Well, that's a...
Unless they're going to war with themselves.
They could be totally aggressive and always fighting each other and, like, killing the weak ones among them. You know, you have no idea how tough these guys are.
Yeah, but so far, they just ran up and they kind of fondled them a little bit. That's been about it so far.
Yeah.
And the Eloi are clearly easy prey. I'm just saying there's a possibility they don't know how to fight, and he'd be, like, all Demolition Man, you know? They wouldn't be prepared for his
right.
19th century appetite for violence. They'd be like... I don't understand this. These men are so savage. Right after this section, there was another phrase that struck me. It says, well, mace in one hand and Weena in the other, I went out of that gallery. Like, wait a minute, did she shrink some more?
Yeah, I know. It makes it sound like she's an action figure at this point. Is she?
He's just hanging on to her. What the heck?
Is she like a foot tall? Is that how little she is?
I don't know.
As he moves out, he notices what's left of a lot of books. And he thinks about the wasted labor of all these things, how they're worth nothing to anybody. It really makes you think about the whole point of humanity and what we're building to. And are we actually going to be building to anything? All of the work and the labor, and you know how nowadays we record everything and all the books and just all the data that's out there, and it's like, what is that going to be good for? What's the uses of those things? And eventually, maybe in the future, it'll end up and it'll just be a big pile of dust.
It's the Ozymandias portion of the book, and it does make you think.
Yeah,
you'd better enjoy what you do, because nobody's immortal. Product really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It'll fade.
Yeah, it's almost like our society has kind of become an Ozymandias. of a sort.
You mean with the social media and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think everybody thinks that they're pretty important, and the things they do are pretty important.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to leave their mark, but with so many people now leaving their marks, like, what does that really mean anymore?
Well, they're leaving too many marks, too, you know.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
a great Norm Macdonald bit about it where he says, you know, my great-grandpa or his grandpa, one picture, that's it.
Yeah.
You want to see what he looks like? You look at that one picture. He goes, but in the future, somebody will say, hey, you want to see 100,000 pictures of my grandpa? No.
Exactly. No. Well, I was looking at baby pictures of me and my dad's Super 8 films that he has of us because, you know, when I was a kid, VHS was not a thing.
Right.
There's no video. So there's, you know, maybe 2 to 3 minutes worth of me that exists on film as a child.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have probably an hour's worth of footage just on my phone. not counting all of the downloaded material that I have. You know, it's like, who's going to look at this stuff in the future? Am I going to...
Are you even going to look at it?
Exactly.
I feel that way all the time when I'm at concerts and people, everybody's like looking at it through their phone, or even when in museums and places you go, I understand the want to capture it, but I just am suspicious that you're ever going to look at these things.
Yeah, exactly.
You should put it down and get it in your head now and enjoy it, because you're never going to go back and look at that photo.
It's true. Yeah. This part of the story really makes me think about that. Again, it's great science fiction because I stop and I'm thinking about this stuff and I'm thinking about how it applies to my society and my life. And this book was written over 100 years ago.
Yeah. And it has incredibly positive ramifications, too. I mean, like I say, what I took out of that was, well, you could be stressing because you didn't write the great American novel. But guess what? The great American novel is going to be in dust.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah.
So if what you prefer is, you know, writing some Philby time traveler / fiction, you know, do that.
Have at it.
Go crazy.
Do it.
Just do the thing that pleases you, because it's pointless to try and pursue immortality.
They go by this well-preserved chemistry set and he looks around it for a second and he finds a box of matches. He tries them and they work. And I'm thinking, dude, 800,000 years?
Yeah.
To give this story the benefit of the doubt, I started to wonder if maybe there had been other civilizations before this.
Yeah.
Like maybe this happens over and over again. Like a civilization gets really advanced, hits a dark age, takes a few millennia to raise back up again, rinse and repeat.
Exactly. I mean, those matches may only be a couple hundred years old.
Right.
This is possibly my favorite scene in the book related to those matches.
Mm-hmm.
When he finds them, he is so happy that they work. This scene goes down.
I found a box of matches. Very eagerly, I tried them. They were perfectly good. They were not even damp. I turned to Weena. Dance, I cried to her in her own tongue, for now I had a weapon indeed against the horrible creatures we feared. And so, in that derelict museum, upon the thick, soft carpeting of dust, to Weena's huge delight, I solemnly performed a kind of composite dance. In part it was a modest can-can, in part a step dance, in part a skirt dance, so far as my tailcoat permitted, and in part original, for I am naturally inventive, as you know.
That is a weird scene, man.
I read it and I just didn't think much of it, you know, like I'm like, hey, whatever. But reading it on its own.
He just expressed his happiness through interpretive dance.
He did.
To Weena.
But he also commanded her.
Yeah, he commanded. I kind of feel like they left something out. Did he go dance and she was just like, He's like, I'll show you what dance can do. Such a weird thing. It made me think too, because if you're in the future, they don't know what your customs are, so you can make anything up. You can be like, we do this all the time.
Maybe he doesn't actually command her to dance, because he says dance. I cried in her own tongue. He doesn't say he's telling her to dance. Maybe he just was like, the idea hit him and he said it to himself, like, I'm going to dance.
Yeah, or maybe he said it to her because he was like, this, you're about to see what dance is. You guys with your little flitting around in the forest, forget it. Watch this.
If anybody remakes this into a film a third time, he's got to have the dance scene in there.
Got to, like, be there.
Full
Should be
on.
At least 10 minutes.
He also finds some camphor. He thinks that his lever club might be able to pry open those bronze doors as well. So he's like, okay, you know, this is working out. And then I'm like thinking, look how much he gets done when he's got some Morlocks lighting a fire under his ass. You know what I mean? Like, he was sitting there for like hours just looking around at stuff, being an idiot. And once his Morlocks showed up, he got his fire, he got his weapon, and he got his tool to get open those doors.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had some Morlocks menacing me when I was trying to get these notes done.
That could be your next business venture.
Yeah.
Cannibalistic humanoid underground motivators. Chum. Got a term paper coming up. Hire the chum.
So on his way out, he also finds some cases with swords and weapons, even some guns. A lot of it is rusted, and he felt like his iron lever was probably the most strong thing there.
It was after that, I think, that we came to a little open court within the palace. It was turfed and had three fruit trees, so we rested and refreshed ourselves. Towards sunset, I began to consider our position. Night was creeping upon us, and my inaccessible hiding place had still to be found. But that troubled me very little now. I had in my possession a thing that was perhaps the best of all defenses against the Morlocks. I had matches. I had the camphor in my pocket, too, if a blaze were needed. It seemed to me that the best thing we could do would be to pass the night in the open, protected by a fire. In the morning, there was the getting of the time machine. Towards that, as yet, I had only my iron mace. But now, with my growing knowledge, I felt very differently towards those bronze doors. Up to this, I had refrained from forcing them, largely because of the mystery on the other side. They had never impressed me as being very strong, and I hoped to find my bar of iron not altogether inadequate for the work.
And that's where we're going to stop off for now. He's got a plan.
Yeah.
He's got his tools.
He's got the talent. It's Miller time.
This guy's going to go on a hunt for Morlocks.
I mean, really excited, but I'm also a little sad that this is our penultimate episode on the time machine.
Yeah, we got to bring it to a close. And there really isn't that much story left, although
No. The
story that is left has some really big, crazy concepts in it.
Yeah, it does.
So those are going to be really fun to talk about next week.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I want to thank Greg Johnson for bringing the thunder and laying it down upon my ears. He is amazing and awesome.
Always welcome at my birthday parties, Greg.
Any of my parties, he's welcome.
Thanks for listening today. I'm Chad Fife.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.